Welcome to the Denmark Street Deep Dive, a podcast designed to feed your enthusiasm for the world of Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, the creations of the fabulous J.K. Rowling, writing as Robert Galbraith. This is a fan creation full of shameless fangirling and analysis of the Strike series of books, their TV adaptations and associated fandom. Fair warning for all those who want to avoid spoilers, this time I'm looking specifically at The Cuckoo's Calling, and I can't promise that details from other books won't get a mention, so please bear that in mind before continuing to listen. I do give everything away.
Where shall I say you are if anyone important calls?
Down the boozer.
The Cuckoo's Calling is the first of the Strike novels, in which we meet both Robin and Strike in particular, and in which Rowling begins her painstakingly detailed and rich tapestry of their lives, mostly based in this first book, in London. Neither of the two protagonists are London natives. Robin comes from Yorkshire, drawn down to the capital city by the ambitions of her boyfriend, who becomes her fiancé just before we meet her. Strike hails from Cornwall originally, though his childhood was marked by periods of instability as his rather feckless mother shifted around with Cormoran and his sister Lucy. And as a soldier, he travelled widely before settling in London on his medical discharge and beginning his pride and joy, the detective agency, which forms the heart of these stories. The case involves the purported suicide of Lula Landry, a supermodel. It draws us into the world of fame and celebrity and the pressures involved with a life in the public eye. Princess Diana is invoked more than once, and the clamour and rapid clicks and flashes of the paparazzi seem to echo through the story. The other strong theme is that of adoption and all the implications involved. Lula is adopted, and it is her brother, John Bristow, also adopted, who hires Strike to investigate whether she was, in fact, murdered. Further stern spoiler warning, I'm about to reveal the killer, so stop here if you need to. I think the reality is that Bristow would have been better off saving his money, given that he was the killer himself, and no one actually suspected it had been murder, so his attempt to pin the murder on Lula's blood brother, which also meant that Strike was able to uncover that Bristow murdered his adopted brother Charlie, one of Strike's childhood friends, was entirely wasted effort on his part.
Now, the inquest verdict said suicide, but I think she was murdered.
The adoption idea is most strong in the case itself, with the victim, Lula, nicknamed Cuckoo, being a part of a family of adopted siblings. But it spills into other aspects of the book, as we learn about Strike's nomadic childhood with his mother, and the important grounding and stability he and his sister had by being, for all intents and purposes, adopted by their Aunt Joan and Uncle Ted. There's the more subtle idea of nesting too, as Strike leaves the relationship and home he shared with his girlfriend Charlotte and begins to bed down in his office. And the nesting connection feeds back into the case too, even though it appears that Lula is the cuckoo of the title, given her name, it's John Bristow who best fits that moniker, as he sets up in the Bristow family nest, and, exactly as a cuckoo in the nest of the bird of another species, pushes his rivals out to their deaths from a height. First Charlie, then Lula, and eventually his blackmailer Rochelle too. In terms of the theme of fame, there's a quote from Tennyson at the end of the book, once Strike has solved the case and achieved a measure of fame, that neatly draws together the ideas. It's from Ulysses, and the key phrase is, "I am become a name." A name is the marker of fame. Strike has indeed made a name for himself here. It's also an identity. People often get the name Cormoran Strike wrong in the books, and he sometimes corrects them, but he's fairly loosely connected to it, certainly to his first names, and I've already alluded to the many, many nicknames he has before. Because what's in a name, really? There's a contradiction in that a name has power, yet in itself is curiously empty. Taking this somewhat wider, and this is a bit meta, but bear with me. The books themselves are written under a pseudonym. Robert Galbraith was initially intended to conceal identity and give Rowling the freedom to write without the baggage that Potter fame had brought her. It's the very emptiness of the false name that brings her power. And that's without even taking into account the fact that J.K. Rowling is itself an affectation to avoid the cultural assumptions associated with a more obviously female name. Fame is very much a mixed blessing, as the book underlines time and again, which brings us to the epigraphs.
When you start an investigation, Robin, it's like looking into an aquarium for the first time. Walk around, check how many fish there are. See what happens when you tap the glass.
I love Burke's Cornish pronunciation of the word glass there. Of the many rich layers in the Strike books, the epigraphs are some of my favourites. I'm not the only one who finds much in them to enjoy. If you want to really dig further, check out the work of Dr. Beatrice Groves for some really in-depth treatment of the epigraphs across the whole series. The first epigraph in The Cuckoo's Calling gives us one of our themes. Unhappy is he whose fame makes his misfortunes famous. This most obviously means the untimely demise of the famous supermodel, but also perhaps the life of Strike himself, whose background meant that some of the least happy events in his life received more attention than he would have liked. Other epigraphs also touch on specific events in the chapters that follow, particularly the epigraph to Part 4. And the best plan is, as the popular saying was, to profit by the folly of others. In these chapters, various witnesses afford Strike crucial breakthroughs because of their own folly. Guy Semey, with his garrulous, bitchy, gossipy flamboyance. Abuser Freddie Bestigui, whose ill treatment of his wife Tansy means there is both a witness to prove Lula was murdered and enough leverage for Strike to get that information out of Bestigui. And, as a little flourish, this part of the book also shows us Strike having Robin mention to John Bristow that Strike has had death threats involving stabbing, with the intent of using Bristow's egotistical folly to channel what Strike suspects will be Bristow's attempt to murder him in a manner that Strike can expect.
Yeah, it's Rochelle on a Friday. I lost my appointment card. It's 13th of November, 1994. Do you want to know the time as well? What address you got for me there? Because I've been moving about a bit since I last saw you. Yeah. Just tell me what address you got for me there. Thank you. How's that?
Not bad.
In the TV adaptation, Holiday Granger is a Robin with instant aptitude for detective work and undercover skills. But Book Robin takes a little longer to hit her stride. She's clearly got the desire and the instincts, but her Aussie accent is described as strangled, and when she uses the fake name Annabelle, Strike casually points out that names that have to be made up on the spot, presumably due to nerves, usually start with an A. This little bit of Strike wisdom comes back in a telling way a little while later, in a scene which has quite the iconic status. In the book, it's probably where those latent instincts and talents that Robin has finally shine. In the TV series, it's the first time we see the green dress. In relation to our look at epigraphs, the dress is related in my mind to two of these. Part 3's, maybe one day it will be cheering even to remember these things. And the final epigraph, nothing is an unmixed blessing. At the time she tries it on, Strike is blindsided by how good she looks in it, and makes a sterling effort to appear neutral. Readers who are paying attention won't be fooled, and the scene on television might as well be captioned as Strike thinking, OK, now I'm in trouble. But given that Strike is still deep in the need to block out any of these reactions and feelings, this isn't something that he's relishing in the moment. However, we know from references in later books that it's a memory he holds in some fondness. Given this, it makes sense to see the dress as a mixed blessing, both at the time when it disquiets him with attraction and later when he decides he's going to buy it for Robin as a parting gift. He doesn't want her to leave. He wants to keep her, with the same visceral desire with which he wanted to keep a grass snake he found as a boy. As an aside, I think it's noteworthy that a grass snake is non-venomous, and the green dress is initially described as poison green, but Robin is emphatically the least poisonous person Strike knows. In fact, here's a contrast for you. Strike's metaphor for Charlotte and his feelings for her is of an infection that keeps flaring up. And one of the toxic ways she has behaved is to use her absence to punish him. Robin, however, as he realises in chapter 9 of part 4, uses absence as a tactful, caring thing when he has his monster hangover after she finds him drunk and gets him home. Already, their relationship is grounded in something so much healthier. A Kairos moment indeed. But back to the dress. The grand gesture with so many complications tied in with it. There's the financial cost, of course. It sets the bar for gifts extravagantly high, something which Strike regrets. And it further stokes the jealousy of Matt, as a green dress appropriately might. All told, this dress fitting is genuinely pivotal, and Rowling shows us how discombobulated Strike is in quite a subtle way. Remember Strike telling Robin and us about people who have to make up names on the spot, nearly always going with an A name? Strike will not be inexperienced with using fake names. But what name does he use in Vashti? Andrew Atkinson. I think we can consider his equilibrium thoroughly disturbed.
What do you think?
Yeah.
I've raced through The Cuckoo's Calling here, trying to tease out a few strands of a book crammed with detail. I hope I've encouraged you to revisit it and see what else you can mine out of what Rowling has created. Next time, I'll be moving on to The Silkworm in similar fashion. My ongoing thanks to the other Strike obsessives and Strelicott shippers, especially those of you who have been so supportive of this era podcast. If you'd like me to deep dive into anything specific in future episodes, you can find me at Clara Strike on Twitter. I'm signing off today, having put the kettle on for a pot noodle before a kip on a camp bed. Cheerio.
Lucky you.